You're listening to Season 2, Episode 21 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, storytellers? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. Their MFA writing program has been around for 35 years. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. We have the lovely Debbie Maycomer in today's episode. Debbie is a number one New York Times bestselling author and one of today's most popular writers with more than 200 million copies of her books in print worldwide. Her novels have spent over 950 weeks on the New York Times bestselling list, with 10 of these novels hitting the number one spot. Debbie and I discuss the inspiration behind her newest book, A Girl's Guide to Moving On, and her adult coloring book, The World of Debbie Maycomer, Come Home to Color. An exciting announcement, we're giving both of these books away to one lucky winner. For a chance to win, listen carefully for the name of the young librarian who gave Debbie her first book she ever read, and tell me the name of that librarian on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Remember to tag me at 88 Cups of Tea so I can find your entry. In today's episode, Debbie also walks us through her experience being on set of the first dramatic scripted Hallmark Channel TV series inspired by her Cedar Cove book series starring Annie MacDowell, which became the number one ranked drama on cable television. We'll be diving into a ton of juicy writing and creativity tips throughout the episode. For example, you'll learn the five words Debbie uses to determine the success of her work, and you can also learn how to apply the techniques that Debbie uses to improve plotting, pacing, and character introductions in her work. And we'll be covering one of my favorite topics, where Debbie covers how to not let ego get in the way of your writing. Now let's jump right in. Debbie, how are you doing today? What's up?
Oh, it's such a beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest. The sun is shining. It's in the 80s. I can hardly wait to get home and get in our spa pool.
Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. I love it up there. I've taken a road trip up there before, and I might be taking another one soon. And I'm so jealous. It sounds just gorgeous. And Debbie, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here with us. First, I'd love to kick it off and ask you how you fell in love with writing.
Well, I think that started at a very young age. About the time I was 4 years old and my mother took me to the library for the first time, and the librarian handed me a book, my mother said that I grabbed hold of that book and brought it right next to my heart. And from that moment forward, I never went to bed without a book in my hands. And in fact, to this very day, I'm exactly the same way. I go to bed every night with a book in my hand. And the great part of that is the librarian who handed me that very first book was Beverly Cleary.
What?
Yes, you heard that right. She was a very young librarian. It was her very first year. She was in Yakima, Washington, where I grew up, and she's the first person who ever handed me a book.
Wow, I just got goosebumps all over. That's an amazing story. Were you, after you published your first book, did you ever reach out to Beverly and to let her know?
You know, I never have, and she just celebrated her 100th birthday on, I believe it was April 12th, and I really do need to reach out and tell her that I was that little girl.
Oh my goodness, that is so inspiring. Yes, you need to reach out to her and let her know. Oh my goodness, that is such a cool story. I love that. So from then, when she passed you your first book ever, what were the steps that brought you to write your first book?
It really came into fruition on my own. I'm dyslexic, and really the gift that I have, the gift God gave me, is that of being a storyteller. But I always knew I wanted to write books. However, I didn't learn to read until I was in the fifth grade. The concept of sounding out words for this dyslexic little girl was beyond me, and I struggled all through school. The third grade teacher told my mother Debbie's a nice little girl, but she is never going to do well. And it became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy because I married as a teenager and we had 4 babies in 5 years. But that dream of being a writer never went away. The way I like to describe it is that if you hurt or cut yourself, it will throb with pain. But every time I thought about writing books, I throbbed with joy. This happy anticipation would come over me and this just joyful feeling that this was something I wanted to do so badly. Just recently, I found a diary, a journal entry from 1973, and it was a spiral-bound notebook and half of it was unwound. I'm sure the kids had done that. And it said, January 1st, 1973, since the greatest desire of my life is to somehow, some way, be a writer, I'll start with the pages of this book. Even then, it took until 1978 when there was a death in our family. I had a cousin that I grew up with that I was very close to who died of leukemia. And after David died, it was as if God was saying to me, you can't stuff your dreams into the future. So we rented a typewriter. I didn't know another writer in the whole world, and I still think it was a really good idea, and I tell people to do this. I took 4 books that I loved so much, because I had no college education. I was lucky to get out of high school. And 4 books that I loved, and I dissected them. I went over them scene by scene, chapter by chapter, and outlined the books. In the process, I learned about plotting and pacing, how to introduce characters, to bring in backstory, point of view, how to open a chapter, how to end a chapter. So it was a good tutorial for me.
Do you remember a particular story or novel that really helped catapult you into writing your first book? Do you remember that particular novel or story?
I do. It was Kathleen Woodowitz's book called The Wolf and the Dove. I loved that book so much that I'd actually memorized the first page. I can even remember the first line of it. The clang of the battle rang no more. And that was the very first line. And I loved that story so much that it made me realize, I want to do this. I want people to pick up my stories and feel the way I feel as I read this book.
Was there another fiction that you read or another book that you read that made you think differently about fiction?
Oh, let me think. I think maybe The Exorcist.
Oh.
I know, it's such a scary book. It made me realize how fiction can influence and attack the emotions, like fear or love or... Well, it's interesting now because I have what I call my wall of mentors. I write upstairs in a turret. And on the stairway, on the way up, I have collected author signatures from the books that I read as a child and as a young adult that greatly influenced me. So on my wall, I have Ernest Hemingway, Mark Twain, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and I'm reminded every day as I walk up those stairs of my responsibility as an author and the power of a story. I mean, just like The Exorcist, which was so frightening that, but just think, Pearl S. Buck is on my wall. Her book, A Good Earth, which is about China and life in China, helped change foreign policy between the United States and China. And then Harriet Beecher Stowe, when President Lincoln met her, he said to her, so you're the little lady that started this great war. The power of a story.
Absolutely. And I know that your work is said to bring life to compelling relationships that embrace family and enduring friendships, uplifting readers with stories of connection and hope. I really resonate with that. And I'm really curious, do you draw inspiration from your own relationships?
I think that usually anything that happens in my life will turn up in a book. Not always, but a good portion. And my editor once said that I was a great observer of people. And that was a very nice compliment. And I think she's probably right, because I have used many of the situations and things that I have seen around me in stories. For example, the book I'm writing right now is about a woman who is in a bad car accident, and the hero is emotionally wounded. So as she's healing physically, he's healing emotionally. And the idea for that came from a woman that I met who met her husband while she was healing from an a bicycle accident. And that just kind of inspired the idea.
I know that you right now have a book that's recently released called A Girl's Guide to Moving On. What inspired you to write about that book and about the characters?
Well, the idea for the characters actually came from the Bible, from the story of Ruth and Naomi. They were daughter-in-law and mother-in-law, and they encouraged and inspired each other to move from a different land back to Israel. And they became a support system. And the mother-in-law was the great encourager to her. So I took that idea and described it in modern day times with a mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. I have had several friends who've had husbands that strayed, so to speak, and that cheated in their marriage. And everybody acts differently. One of them decided that she would stay in the marriage and do what she could to maintain the marriage. She had already been through one divorce. She didn't want to go through another. And the other two others have divorced and moved on in their lives. One has never remarried and one did remarry. So seeing those incidences in my friends' lives, I had a good feeling of watching them and their lives and how they developed after the divorce.
I'd love to know, what was the reaction to that book?
I get lots of mail from readers, and I welcome it in the cover of my book or on the first page. I always write a letter to the readers, and I generally tell them where I got the idea from the story, and I always tell them that it's important that I get feedback from them. And the response has been, for the most part, very positive, but there's always a few who will say, well, I don't think they should have done this or that, or this doesn't feel right to me. Or one comment that I've gotten a couple of times has been that they thought that Nikolai was too jealous. He reacted in too much of a jealous way. And I always take those comments to heart. The readers have changed the course of my career about 3 or 4 different times, just simply by the things that they have written to me. And I've learned from my dad, who, well, he's been gone over 10 years now, but he had his own business, and he always gave more than what was expected. And that's what I like to do with my books. I like to give the reader something more, a benefit, something added that will increase their pleasure in the book. So oftentimes I will include a recipe, or I will include like a knitting pattern, or just the letter itself. And readers respond to that.
That's interesting. Are you saying there have been requests where they want to see the actual recipe?
Actually, right on, because the recipe one, when I was writing the Cedar Cove series, I often would mention a food in there like Terry Polgar's macaroni and cheese, and the office would get flooded with, please share that recipe. So I collected those letters and gave them to my publisher, and I said, let's do a cookbook. And so they did, and it was actually made the Times list, and it's a very successful cookbook.
That is amazing. Congratulations. I love that you took what your fans say to heart and you just run with it. Were there other things that they've mentioned that you also took to heart and changed?
Yeah, there's two that are really good examples. Over the years, I've written about communities, and I did like 6 books set in Texas and 6 books set in Alaska and 4 books in North Dakota. And even now, I get mail about those series of books. And they want to know what's happened to this character or that character. And it finally dawned on me that the readers didn't want to let go of those characters. They had fallen in love with them the same way I had. And that was the result from their feedback that I decided to write the Cedar Cove series. I didn't know how many books would be in that series. I decided I would write the series until all the stories were told. And there ended up being like 13 or 14 books. And that came from just the readers wanting to continue on with the characters. Another example is my Christmas books. When I first was contracted for the Christmas books, It was only for like 100, 110 pages. And the feedback I got from the readers was, love you, love the story, but I wanted more. Now, I wanted to be a value-added author. Now, I was contracted for 3 more of those Christmas books. The publisher didn't pay me a penny more, but I doubled and a half the word length so that the readers got above and beyond what I was contracted for. But the sales of those books escalated. They became movies, and that all came about as a result of reader feedback.
Wow, that is so awesome. I love hearing that. That's amazing. And now I know they were adapted into Hallmark movies. How was the response to those movies? First of all, how did you feel when you're on set? I bet that was amazing that you gave all these job opportunities to the crew and the actors.
The first time, I was just there for a day, and it was the second movie. My first movie was made by Showtime. And I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was surprised they even bought the book, because the only thing they really used was the characters' names and the situation. My husband has a very succinct way of putting it. He looked at me and he says, well, Debbie, that check cleared. So I guess that was good enough. The Hallmark experience has been completely different. I've been on set. I've met the actors. I've got to know the producer really well. And it was just such a wonderful experience from beginning to end. The movies itself, the first one was Mrs. Miracle with Doris Roberts, who died just last month. And being able to meet her and be with her was just wonderful. And to be on the set itself was quite the experience. Later on, when the Cedar Cove series was being filmed, I was also on the set, and I had such a great time. One of the men that was carrying the cables behind the cameraman, they just finished the scene, and he turned, and I was just trying to stay out of everybody's way. And he looked at me and he says, I understand you're the author of the books this is based on. And I said, yes, I'm just grateful to be here and see it being filmed. And he said, I want to thank you. Without you, I wouldn't have a job.
Oh, wow.
And that really, I mean, I got tears in my eyes, because I had no idea when I sat down in front of that computer, the rippling effects of that story that would employ literally hundreds of people for 3 years.
Did that entice you to want to go into screenwriting and even movie producing?
No, not at all.
If anything, no, it scared you, huh?
Yeah. As part of my contract with the Cedar Cove series and the movies too, was to review the scripts. And when you look at these scripts, it's an economy of words. There's so little that is on the page and so much that the actors contribute to each scene, each sentence, the inflection that I have so much admiration for Annie McDowell. I was in 2 scenes as part of the Cedar Cove series, 1 scene in season 2 and 1 scene in season 3. And, you know, that talent is so apparent when you're behind the camera or in front of the camera and you think you know your lines. It's really hard. It's really hard. When that camera starts going, I just kind of froze before I could get the words out. And, you know, even though I'd said them 1,000 times in my head, just getting them out was... And it was all I could do to remember the words, let alone, you know, any actions having to do with it. I'm just much more comfortable behind the screen of a computer than in front of a camera.
That is too funny, but I'm sure the fans were thrilled.
Oh, they loved it. Yeah, they did. It was fun because the last scene I was in was a courtroom scene, and we needed an audience in the scene. So I invited 2 of my best friends from high school and their husbands to come.
You totally hooked up your best friends with a movie gig. That's amazing.
Yeah. And they so loved having, you know, and Annie was so wonderful to us all. First of all, she had a dozen roses delivered to, I had my own little trailer even though I was just one little scene, I had my own trailer. She had a dozen roses delivered to my trailer from her. And she went and sat down and had lunch with my high school friends and I. And, you know, they were so agog, they could barely speak. But she was so warm and welcoming, and I just have so much admiration for her.
What an amazing experience, right? Like, look at this. This is what you created for yourself and everyone else around you. That is such a beautiful thing. Debbie, you're amazing. Did you know that?
Oh, well, thank you. I'll let my husband know you said so.
Oh, don't worry. I'll send him a nice little email. How about that?
Okay. Yeah.
But you know what? I think that's incredible. And, you know, touching back on the actual writing process of your books, do you still have that outlining habit for yourself, or have you sort of transitioned to a different way of writing now?
Well, I don't outline other people's books anymore, but because I'm a storyteller, I have ideas all the time. I mean, I could come up with a book plot every single day. That's just the gift God gave me. So now, when it comes to deciding what plot idea I am going to develop, I've come up with 5 words. And if the plot premise can align to these words, then I know I have a good idea. And I'll tell you what they are. The story idea has to be relevant to my reader. And I know who they are. I read their letters. I read their emails. So I know my reader. I have actually done studies about who reads my books. It has to be provocative. I want my reader to think, I'm not going to hit them over the head with an idea. I'm not going to discuss the disease of the week. I want it to just relate to their lives and be relevant and provocative. If they found that their husband had been cheating on them, what would they do? How would they move on? So it's just the thought process. It has to be entertaining. I'm here to tell a story. It has to be honest, or another way of saying that is it has to be realistic. I can't have an idea that's so far-fetched that the reader is not going to identify with it. And it has to be told in the most creative way I can think to tell the story. Oftentimes, when I start a book, it's where I started because, you know, these people's lives is a long line, and I'm intersecting at the beginning and at the end of my story. I'm just intersecting 2 lines in that long line. And where do I start telling the story? And I believe that, I think it was Sandy Brown, another author, who said, you start the story as close to the end as you can and still tell the whole story. And I thought that was good advice.
That is fantastic advice. I know you say you can come up with an idea every single day, but then you only choose the ones that really fit the criteria that you have. But I'm sure you still have a lot even after you whittle it down. So how do you remember all these ideas?
There are a couple of ways I keep track of them. I have an idea file. So if I get an idea, I'll put, you know, that I think is really good, I'll put it in the file. A lot of them, you know, I understand right away is it would never work because it simply doesn't align with that. That may be enough creativity in it or different enough that I'll bend everything to make it work. But I just have a file and I will write up just a few lines or so and have Renata save it for me or put it in another file. But mostly I just come up with them as I go.
And now when you do actually write them and you're plotting your own outlines, are you writing it on a computer or do you write it by hand in a notebook?
Well, I kind of do a combination of both. When I start to plot a book, I'm one of these people that there's 2 different kinds of writers in the world. There are the plotters and the pantsers. And the pantsers are people who write by the seat of their pants. They just get an idea. They sit down and they start writing. They're so excited, they can hardly wait to get to the computer to write it. And that works. And there's lots of wonderful writers that do exactly like that. I need to know beforehand where that story is going to go and how it's going to end. I don't want to get to the middle and call it the muddle. You know, I want to know what's going on. So I sit down and immediately start plotting with a pen and a paper. And I know how many chapters there are going to be in the book because I know how many words I'm contracted for. And it usually is between 33 and 36 chapters. And so I will make up a scene for every one of those chapters. So I'll have a page in which I write 1 to 36 down, and I just get ideas. There's a yellow tablet that I'll just start off with, you know, bouncing ideas on the yellow tablet or just coming up with certain ideas. Then I'll do that 1 through 36, and I'll start writing a scene for every chapter. That's a skeleton. And so then from that skeleton, I will write the synopsis. I'll start off with giving a little bit of the backstory and what makes these characters who they are. And then I will start with chapter 1, and it says, the story begins with, and I'll go through and I'll make about a paragraph, just sometimes longer, for every one of those scenes. And that is my selling outline, and it is my working outline. So when it comes time to write the book, I look at that paragraph and I read what I'm going to be writing that day and add the flesh to it. And one of those scenes equals between 1 and 15 pages. And that's how I write the book. Every day there is that one paragraph or longer that I tell the story in a chapter by chapter so that it is a flow. It flows smoothly, that the editor has had a chance to read it so she knows where the story is going to end or beginning, and she knows where it's going to end. And they offer me their feedback, in which I'll go back and change the synopsis so that I have just a timetable. And then when it comes time to write the book, I take a calendar page and I write down how many pages I need to write each day in order to make my deadline. I'm very generous with myself. And then at the end of the day, I put an X to the day and I put either a plus sign or a minus sign. But I very, very seldom have minus signs. I'm very careful because I'm very generous with myself to give myself plenty of time. And then when the book's done, it's ready to send off. I have to give it to Renata, my assistant, to read through because I'm still dyslexic and I still make mistakes. So she reads it through and cleans it up for me, and then it goes off.
That's so awesome. So how long usually in general is your writing process from beginning to the end of your first draft of your manuscript?
First draft, it's hard to answer that because, you know, people ask me, well, how long does it take you to write a book? And that's very difficult to answer because every book is different. The writing process is the easy, fun part. It's the before part. When people ask me that, I compare it to painting a room. You know, when you want to paint a room, you've got to move the furniture, you've got to tape the windows and cut in. But when it comes to the actual painting part, that's the fun part. And then the after part, when you have to put everything back. And when I write a book, there's all that before preparation and all that after preparation too. So the writing process only takes me about 6 to 8 weeks.
The revisions are usually, I'm assuming, like about several months afterwards?
No, the editors are really good about reading the book right away. And I will have feedback within 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'll start on the revisions. And there are always revisions. I mean, I'd like to say after 30-some years that, you know, I'm just so good at this that I don't need revisions, but I do. And I don't have my ego wrapped around my writing. And that has been a blessing because I had to learn to be the writer. The storytelling came naturally to me, but the writing didn't. And I struggled with that. And even now, I struggle with the writing process. I'm not good with description because I want to tell the story. I don't want to get bogged down with what the room looked like or what the heroine is wearing. But the amazing part is, and this boggles my mind, is that the readers feel that in themselves. I get so many letters that say, I love the way you describe things. I can so picture that heroine. And I can remember one time my editor said, you didn't give me one word to describe what this heroine looks like. Because to me, it didn't matter. What mattered was the story.
Because you have dyslexia, you have Renata, your amazing assistant, help you go over your work. How much do you think dyslexia has hindered you?
Well, I think, and I actually believe very strongly, that I wouldn't be a storyteller if I didn't have dyslexia. I actually tell children when I meet them that who are dyslexic, oh my goodness, you may not appreciate it now, but you have a gift. Because that gift is your creative side. And I didn't know I was dyslexic until my two boys were diagnosed with it. I always thought that I was below average intelligence. And that was what I was led to believe as a child. And it was only as my boys were going into school, and it's not uncommon for a girl to be dyslexic, but it isn't nearly as common as it is with boys. So having dyslexia, I've come to realize, has been a gift in my life. Now, I didn't think of it that way for a very long time, but those of us that are dyslexic are often very creatively talented.
I'd love to also touch on your coloring book. How fun is that? The World of Debbie Macomber, Come Home to Color. What inspired you to want to make an adult coloring book? I think that's so much fun.
The idea came from my publisher. They had done two previous ones, one by George R. Martin for Game of Thrones and Diane Gabaldon for Outlander. And one of the major retailers, I believe it was Joann's, came to them and said, we'd really like to see one from Debbie Macomber. So the publisher, this was January, and the publisher immediately got on it, and it is a huge print run. I was just shocked at how the orders kept coming in and coming in, and the pictures themselves are just gorgeous. I've gotten lots of great feedback on it, so, and it's selling very well.
That's so much fun. Well, I'm so excited for listeners to check out your book. Can you share with the readers about how many books have you written already in your entire lifetime?
Oh my goodness.
I know, it's a lot.
It is a lot. I can't answer that right down to the number. I know it's over 100, but I've been published now 33 years, something like that. Yeah. I did want to tell you there's something a little different that I'm doing. Over the years, I've done all these community books. And while I enjoy those, and I'll probably continue to do more of those, this last series, the first one was The Last One Home, and the second book in the series, A Girl's Guide to Moving On, and the book I'm writing now, which is called If Not For You, they are more themed than they are community-based or even linked. There are some characters that are in two of the books anyway, maybe three. But the whole idea is that the first book, The Last One Home, is reconciliation. It's about a girl who ran away from home in her teen years and got into a bad marriage in a bad situation. And then after her divorce, she comes back home to reunite with her family. So it's reconciliation. In A Girl's Guide to Moving On, it's about forgiveness. And the book I'm writing now is healing. He heals, she heals. And the next book that I'm going to be starting this summer sometime is Redemption. It's about a woman who's been in prison who comes out of prison. So it's redemption. So these are the themes. Instead of the community, it's the idea of sharing the thoughts. Now, I haven't made it obvious. I haven't said in the reader, this book is about, you know. But it's been a real challenge to me as an author. And I think we have to be challenged to grow. Talent isn't static. You have to grow. You have to learn. You have to stretch yourself as an author and a storyteller to be successful. And that's something I want to do.
What inspired you to make that shift?
I didn't realize what I was doing until I got to the second book. I realized that this was really about forgiveness, especially in the end when Leanne is dealing with Sean. And I thought, and then I realized a lot of my books have forgiveness as a theme. I did an interview just recently with Amazon, and they asked me about if there were certain themes that come through in my books, and I just realized a lot of them are about forgiveness. And I said I didn't understand why, because there isn't anybody that I've had to forgive like a major thing for. And the interviewer's response was really interesting. She said that oftentimes the themes that writers will write is something they're good at themselves. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm able to forgive easily. I didn't ever think about that. But it wasn't until the second book that I realized that I wanted to do themes. And the first one was, you know, that reconciliation was so easy to see. And the forgiveness one was just a natural for me. And then I thought, well, what do I want to do for the third book? So the healing came in.
That's amazing. How else do you think you've evolved creatively aside from changing from community to theme?
Well, it started off early when I was writing for category romance novels. Those were the Harlequin and Silhouette books I wrote early in my career. And it's really interesting because it's those books that started back in the 80s that opened up the publishing world to women authors. If you look at the women authors that are the most successful now, that are around my age, all of us walk through the door with category romance. Nora Roberts, Janet Ivanovich, Sandy Brown. I mean, there's Jane Krentz, dozens of us that came through that door. But the books were shorter. They were only 200 or 250 pages, later on 300. And one of the big transitions for me was writing the longer stories, the longer books. And because I was so accustomed to writing the short stories, the shorter books, I often would involve two or three different storylines in order to stretch the book. And then later, now I didn't have to, but I wanted to grow as a writer to create one story big enough to carry the whole book. So there are all those different little transitions as my career grew. And I went from paperback category romance to mass paperback to hardcover. And when I made the transition from mass paperback to hardcover, I did not want to ask the reader to pay $22 for a story that they had only paid $7.99 for previously. It had to be bigger, it had to be better, it had to be different. So I made the transition from romance to women's fiction. Just another leap that I had to make as an author.
What was the hardest thing that you found about writing?
I think just growing and stretching as an author, the going from the multiple storylines to the one story that's going to, you know, capture the attention and hold their attention for 400 pages. I think that really stretched me as an author. I had to learn to do that. Yeah, so I think that was probably the hardest thing for me.
I know you've mentioned that you've written over 100 books, which is incredible. You have your own headquarters and all of these amazing assistants and employees there with you. It's become like this huge empire of what you've created through your storytelling. What do you feel like you've sacrificed in order to write and to have what you have now?
Well, certainly there has always been sacrifice. In the very beginning, I was a stay-at-home mom and I was taking $100 out of our family budget. You know, we were a sole income family and my husband worked construction. So there were lots of times when there were long periods of unemployment that I was taking out of our family budget. There was sacrifice there. Then later on, as I grew more successful, I mean, I sold my books and I grew more successful, there were sacrifices in family time. Just recently, my husband and I bought a classic car. It was the car that he drove when we met and I fell in love with him. And we thought, as our anniversary is coming up, that our 50th wedding anniversary, that we would buy that car sort of like a romantic remembrance. And he wanted to show it at the August nights in Reno, but the dates of that conflicted with the tour dates that I'm on. So we won't be able to do that. The finding the balance between family life and career. And I think that's a challenge almost anybody that works outside the home and at the home too face. You have to make choices and they often call for sacrifices.
Yes, absolutely. And Debbie, I know in the very beginning you mentioned that your cousin David passed away from cancer. And I know that you've had heartbreaks in your family, including the loss of a son. And I was wondering, has your writing helped you to heal?
I think so, because it gave me something to bury my creativity in. Yeah. I probably did. With David, it's interesting because I tell the story at writers' conferences, and it's a good story. When I first went to see him, he was living in Yakima, and he was transferred over to Seattle, and I was living here in Seattle, so I would go up and see him every day. But the first time that I went, I got lost in the hospital. I stopped and I asked a doctor, you know, how do I get from here to there? And he said, it's so easy. You just go down this corridor, take the first right, go all the way to the end of the hall, and walk through the doors marked absolutely no admittance. And I think that's what we all have to do when we have a dream. We have to be willing to walk through that door. And it was David's death that led me to, you know, giving up the fear and racing ahead and renting that typewriter and starting my writing career. Good can come from sadness, and it does. You just have to look for it and believe that God is going to work this, even this, into a good thing in your life.
Thank you for that, Debbie. I know that was a bit of a touchy subject, but there are listeners out there who are either dealing with loss or have recently, and it helps them to hear how you have dealt with it. So thank you for talking about David. I know you've given us a lot of your time and you've been incredible. I'd love to wrap it up with two more questions and ask you, what was your proudest moment in your career?
Oh, that is so easy to answer. It is, because I was an answer on Jeopardy.
What?
Yes.
That's awesome. Yeah. Are you serious?
I am so serious. I was so excited, and I was watching that night and everything. So it was so cool. And later on, I realized I used it in a devotional even, because if I could be an answer on Jeopardy, maybe God wanted me to be an answer to other things too. So I used it. So, but that is really what I felt was the pinnacle of my career, that I would be an answer on Jeopardy. Now, I'm not smart enough to be on Jeopardy as a contestant, but I can be an answer.
That's pretty impressive. And now, how did you find out about that?
Well, I actually had a forewarning. I had gone into my computer. We have live half the year in our Florida home, and we were in Florida. And I'd gone in after dinner to check emails one last time before I closed down my computer. And I got an email message from one of my editors saying, be sure and watch Jeopardy tonight. You're one of the answers. And so I would have anyway. So it was just so super cool. And of course, the subject was on knitting. So.
That's amazing. And when you were talking about knitting right now, you have a retreat that people can come together and learn how to knit?
The retreat that you're talking about is one that's going to take place in October. It's a wonderful retreat kind of center, that it's a hotel and there's lots of things going on. Knitting is only one. The readers love to spend time in the Pacific Northwest, and they love to spend time with me. We also do, here in my office, just across the parking lot, is a tea room and gift shop. And we do 4 or 5 times a year tea with Debbie. And the readers will come from all over the country for those. We've done Cedar Cove Days in Port Orchard, in which 12,000 people came from all over the world to be part of that. And then Random House did a fan retreat in Nashville, Tennessee, about 4 or 5 years ago. And this year we're doing a fan retreat on Hood Canal. And it's going to be, you know, we want the couples to come. So there's whiskey tastings, there's learning how to make fly fishing lures, there's hikes in the forest, and we have rainforest here, and mushroom hunting, cooking classes, painting classes, and of course, knitting classes. So it's going to be just a lot of fun for a lot of people.
That is so much fun. I love that you're doing this and bringing this community together. Let's wrap it up with the one last question that I love asking all my guests. Is there one or a few books that you can recommend that's made a huge impact on your life? I know you mentioned a few in the very beginning, but if there are any others, I'd love to hear it.
I think one of my all-time favorite books is A Gift from the Sea, which is by Anne Morrow Lindbergh. I so loved that book and the symbolism she wrote about with the life of the sea. That was a real life-changing. And of course, the Bible. I know that sounds, you know, everybody's, of course, the Bible. But the Bible has had a powerful impact on my life. I read it every single day. And as for fiction, I think there are so many authors that I love and read every book they write, that it would be just too hard to even begin to tell you which one. And I would hate to favor one over the other because there are so many. I have discovered that a lot of authors through ebooks, and just one, she isn't with a traditional publisher, but my goodness, can this young girl write? Her name is Amy Harmon, and Making Faces is one of the best books I've ever read. It was so beautifully written and such a beautiful story. And I just read it this year, and I tell everybody about it because it was such a good book.
Debbie, thank you so much. Really lovely talking to you.
Oh, thank you, Ian. I enjoyed it too.
Hey, that wraps up our interview with Debbie Maycomber. Debbie, thank you for your time. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And listeners, thank you as always for joining me. Don't forget, if you'd like a chance to win a copy of Debbie's newest book, A Girl's Guide to Moving On, and a copy of her adult coloring book, The World of Debbie Maycomber, Come Home to Color, be sure to let me know the name of the young librarian who gave Debbie the very first book she ever read. The deadline is Wednesday, June 15th at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more details about Debbie and more info about the resources and books she mentioned, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Debbie Maycomber. You can say hi to Debbie on Twitter at Debbie Maycomber. And guys, one more thing before I head out. I've been listening to your comments and feedback about wanting to publish your work. I truly believe you'll want to hear what our sponsor has to offer, especially if you're a writer or a poet. Vermont College of Fine Arts has two writing programs I want to tell you about. The MFA in Writing is one of the original low residency programs and, frankly, one of the best in the country. Writers gather at VCFA's beautiful campus for two separate 10-day residencies each year. Imagine yourself immersed in a setting much like an intense writer's retreat where you're fully committed to workshops, lectures, and readings. After the residencies, you return home and work with a dedicated faculty advisor throughout the rest of the semester. The MFA in Writing and Publishing is their very first and brand new residential program that also focuses on improving your writing and giving you the tools to thrive in the arts. Every student learns directly from agents, editors, and publishers. The cool thing is that it's a cross-genre program, which means if you're a poet, you're encouraged to learn from faculty in fiction or nonfiction. Imagine yourself learning and creating in this incredible writing community, all while living on their gorgeous campus in Montpelier, Vermont. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA to learn more about these programs and their MFA in Writing for children and young adults. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!